Privyet, and welcome to the Bunker Daily with me, Andrew Harrison. Russia is being convulsed by some of the most serious pro-democracy protests in its recent history, all triggered, at least in part, by the return to Russia and subsequent highly questionable trial of key opposition figure and recovered Novichok target Alexei Navalny. On his return to Russia, Navalny was sentenced to 2 years, 8 months in a prison colony for violating probation terms of a conviction in 2014, which he claims was politically motivated. Now, Russia's prisons are reported to be packed after weeks of arrests at violent protests. Poland, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania are demanding sanctions against Russia over this, and Putin has expelled diplomats from Germany, Sweden and Poland for allegedly attending the protests. What is going on? Is Vladimir Putin, long the most immovable figure in world politics, finally teetering? To help explain, I'm joined by Luke Harding, Guardian journalist and author of the brilliant book Shadow State, Murder, Mayhem and Russia's Remaking of the West. Hello, Luke. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Andrew. Very good to be back on your wonderful podcast.
It's a pleasure. First up, what does the jailing of Navalny mean? It seems immensely kind of almost gratuitously harsh to immediately imprison him the moment he turns up. The message is not only can we put you in prison immediately, but we will make it absolutely clear that we've trumped up the charges and we simply don't care.
Yes. I mean, I think the Kremlin of Vladimir Putin has been debating, vacillating, you might say, for a long time about what to do with Navalny. I mean, Navalny has been quite a big figure in Russian politics for at least a decade. I met him when I was there as the Guardian's correspondent back in 2011, shortly before I was kicked out of the country. And back then, he was a sort of campaigner, a blogger, an anti-corruption activist who came to kind of prominence because essentially he was sort of shining a light on corruption, not just by Putin, but by his friends who practically own all of Russia's strategic enterprises, oil, gas, and so on. And his following got bigger and bigger. He did these terrific video exposés. I mean, the most famous, the one he did recently at Putin's palace, has been seen more than 100 million times, but he did others as well. There were various cases against him. He was arrested. He was released. His brother was jailed for 3 years. Someone attacked him and half blinded him with gunk in his eye. And then eventually, I think last year, exasperated, really fed up with the Navalny problem, it seems pretty clear that Putin authorized a secret operation by his FSB spy agency to have Navalny killed. And of course, as we now know, thanks to the work of Bellingcat, the open source investigative guys, that didn't work. He survived. He was poisoned via his underpants, it seems. He spent 5 months in Germany recuperating. And at that point, when he was there off a ventilator, the Kremlin made it very, very clear that if he were to fly back to Russia, he'd be immediately arrested. And I think their calculation was that he would back down, he would live in Europe, he would be a critic from the sidelines, and slowly but surely he would lose relevance because it's very hard to be a Russian politician if you're not actually in Russia. And then Navalny basically kind of called Putin's bluff. I watched him. I mean, it was live streamed by Russian news networks. I watched his return. There were dozens of journalists with him. He flew back from Berlin to Moscow. And I have to say, it's one of the bravest things I've seen in my life. I mean, he flew back. His plane was diverted. He landed. And no one quite knew what was going to happen. He got as far as passport control, where there were 8 uniformed officers waiting for him. And there's this really poignant moment where he just gives his wife Yulia a kiss goodbye on the cheek and sort of disappears almost into blackness. And even then, he keeps going. I mean, a couple of days later from custody, this Putin Palace video is released. He's been on trial, and he continues to kind of to snap at Putin's heels, to insult him, to get under his skin. The Kremlin is very, very, very angry, angry with Navalny, and I think determined to crush the protests that we've seen in Russia over the last 3 weeks.
Does Navalny have a plan? Because, as you say, with flying back to Russia, when he was, as far as we know, poisoned either on or before he boarded a plane from Tomsk to Moscow in 2020, it seems bold understatement. Does he have a plan?
He does have a plan, or a plan of sorts, I would say. I mean, I was chatting with Leonid Volkov, who's Navalny's right-hand guy in exile currently in Lithuania. And I sort of said, you know, Leonid, where does Navalny's superhuman bravery come from? And he said, well, yes, he is brave, but actually it's quite rational from Navalny's point of view. I mean, he genuinely thinks that the opposition, which he now leads, is historically destined to prevail over what he regards as a group of gangsters, of thieves, crooks, and aging KGB men now in their middle 60s, whose moment has passed. So that's his analysis, and he bases this on the fact that his supporters are young, they're younger than their enemies inside the Kremlin, they're smarter, and that they'll get there. But I mean, Volkov also sort of recognized that it may be that Putin goes on for a while. It may be, as he said to me, that Putin crawls on for another 10 years, but he thinks that they will triumph. And certainly Navalny has been like an electric shock. I mean, he really has roused a lot of people who are normally pretty apathetic, which is part of their sort of Soviet conditioning and legacy, quite stoical, has roused them to protest in freezing conditions and to risk being arrested, jailed, and beaten up, as we've seen on TV in recent days.
This is all taking place against the backdrop of economic and political paralysis, as far as I can see as well. I mean, I was reading Tatiana Stanovaya in the FT this week saying that Russia's effectively has destabilized itself from within, and that Putin has been spending all his time on geopolitics while succeeding day-to-day governing to what she calls a group of faceless technocrats. So is it the economy, stupid, that is beginning to drive that wedge between the populist appeal of Putin?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's the economy, stupid. Living standards have been declining for the past 5 years, and the euphoria following the annexation of Crimea in 2014 has worn off. That sugar rush has gone. And it's also corruption. It's the fact that Putin and his friends, most of them, not all of them from the KGB, but generally from a similar background, have been stealing on a quite cosmic scale for a very long time now. I mean, they are hugely rich. I mean, the reason that the Putin's palace video clocked up more than 100 million views is because of the sort of tawdry ludicrousness of Putin and people like him. I mean, yachts, palaces, Swiss bank accounts, mistresses, property empires ranging from London to the south of France to New York and so on.
The palace is astonishing. It's this kind of opulent supervillain lair on the Black Sea, which contains, amongst other things, a hookah bar with retractable stripper pole, a video game arcade, and an aqua discotheque with a swim-up bar. This is kind of Tony Stark-level indulgence. This has gone down badly in poverty-stricken Russia.
Yes. I mean, it's a naff Bond lair. When I say Bond lair, sort of, you know, the baddie from James Bond, not Bond himself. I mean, Bond's actually got quite good taste, but it is super tacky. And yeah, as you say, underground ice rink. I think you forgot to mention the
how could I forget that?
Yes. Vineyard, the view of the Black Sea, the tunnel. Also, bear in mind, it's got its own no-fly zone and is guarded permanently by the Federal Migration Service. I mean, it clearly doesn't belong to just anybody. And what's interesting is there are two things from the palace which have really become memes in Russia. One is the aqua disco. I didn't even know what an aqua disco was, but apparently it is a thing.
And I want to go to it. I don't know what it is, but I want to go to it.
And the other thing is the gold-colored loo cleaners, which cost $850 each. And there's a lot of really terrible Italian Frenchified furniture. There's a kind of neoclassical vibe going on that's been ordered as well. And it's a monstrosity. And the point is that this palace and the other palaces belonging to the Russian elite, they're not created from labor, enterprise, and so on. They come from the fact that a small section of the population know Vladimir Putin, work with him in the KGB, know him from St. Petersburg in the 1990s. And they're part of this sort of corrupt brotherhood, you might say. And this is what Navalny points out. He's basically saying the emperor's got no clothes. I mean, he called Putin last week a thieving little man in a bunker.
Don't knock bunkers. Don't be mean about bunkers. Jesus.
Thieving little man in a bunker and Vladimir the poisoner of underpants. He said that's how history is going to remember him, not as Vaclav, Vladimir the Great or Vladimir the Wise, but Vladimir the poisoner of underpants. It's this mockery, this painful, sardonic kind of sticking in of the dagger that I think infuriates Putin. Because on some level, I mean, goodness knows what goes on inside Putin's head, but on some level, Putin and the people around him know that this critique is true.
What is so strange about it, though, is, you know, you're right. This is Peter York dictator chic, isn't it? Nasty, gold-trimmed rubbish, not what one associates with the supposedly ascetic Vladimir Putin that he likes to project. You know, this guy likes to ride bears, supposedly. He doesn't like to splash around in the aqua discotheque.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at Navalny's video, and by the way, it's easy to find on YouTube, and it's dubbed, so you don't have to speak Russian to look at it. I mean, he traces his whole career, and essentially the portrait that Navalny paints of Putin is of a grifter, of a petty bureaucrat who, when after the Soviet Union collapsed and he was looking for a job, became an aide to the mayor of St. Petersburg, and immediately started demanding bribes, writing numbers, you know, 25 in dollars on a napkin, $25,000 is the amount he had to be bribed. I mean, that was back then. And now he and his proxies, because formerly, of course, you know, Putin's wealth is not Putin's wealth, but the people who sort of hold his wealth for him and his assets for him, I mean, they're worth many hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, more than Elon Musk, more than Jeff Bezos, certainly more than you and me, Andrew. They're very, very rich. And it's this kind of this greed, but not even sort of clever greed, but really kind of banal greed that I think Navalny has exposed, and which has really infuriated people who, as you say, are suffering and broke and hard up at a time of pandemic, a time of cold, and after a period really of political stagnation where they are seeing the same faces, one face in particular, night after night on their television screens.
Circling back to those protests, how strong is the opposition in Russia now? We are not used to imagining that there is any particular strength of opposition politics. They have no access to the media or the courts. You've described how Navalny has used digital media a lot, but you know, how strong is Russia's opposition?
It's a good question. I mean, I think what's changed is that Navalny has genuinely become a national figure in Russia, despite, as you say, being blacklisted, banned from TV, or if he does appear on TV, it's to smear him. Paradoxically, what the Kremlin has done in recent years is it's driven other opposition figures out of the country, people like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the jailed oligarch who's now in London, or Garry Kasparov, the former World Chess Championship champion who fled and now lives in Croatia, or they've been murdered. People like Boris Nemtsov, who was a former deputy prime minister, turned major liberal opposition figure, who was shot dead outside the Kremlin in 2015. And so Navalny is the last person standing. I think you can exaggerate his support. It would be wrong to suggest that all Russians support him. They don't. I mean, Putin is still very popular. But his name recognition has grown and his ratings have grown. I mean, he I think 20% of Russians would vote for him. But bearing in mind that those kind of opinion polling exercises are pretty moot in Russia, because if someone rings up, you don't know, and says, would you vote against Vladimir Putin? You don't go, duh.
Who's asking?
Yes, of course. Because you know what that means. So, but what we have seen in recent weeks, last 3 weeks, January 23rd, January 31st, is we've seen the biggest street protests since 2011, 2012, which followed Kremlin election fraud. And we've also seen a sort of geographical spread that we haven't seen before, about 180 towns and cities all across Russia. There were even people demonstrating in Yakutsk in the Far East in minus 50. I was actually talking to a photographer from Yakutsk yesterday who was there. And the images are of whiteness. It looks like a snowstorm. You can see a small group of people protesting surrounded by a small black-white group of police. And if you can get people to protest in minus 50, then it means you are cutting through.
Yeah, they feel pretty strongly about it. I mean, on that issue of approval ratings, even though, I mean, I wasn't aware they had approval ratings in Russia. I thought in Russia, state approves you know, but he has been registering low figures, record lows last year. How strong and secure is Putin really, do you think?
Well, I mean, it would be lovely to say that, like in a Hollywood drama, that the good guys will prevail, that there'll be a peaceful uprising, that the security state will yield, that the OMON riot police will hang up their truncheons and start taking flowers from the crowds. But I don't see that scenario. I mean, on the one hand, you've got a group of quite often middle class, not only middle class demonstrators, sort of educated people, people who listen to podcasts, by the way. And on the other hand, you have a vast sort of corrupted bureaucracy and a pretty loyal security apparatus, people who follow orders and do what they're told. And I don't see Putin or the people around him being ready to relinquish power, or even really share power. And I think what they will do is what they've always done in these situations, which is to rely on forced solutions and the fact that the Kremlin completely dominates all of Russia's institutions, whether it's TV, the judicial system, prosecutors, politics, and so on. So I think more opposition activists will be jailed on basically fake charges. Navalny will stay behind bars, and the regime will try and do what Alexander Lukashenko in next door Belarus is trying to do, which is just to tough things out and eventually detain enough people, decapitate the opposition, that the protests go away.
But for all that, I mean, nothing lasts forever. Where do you think we are in the Putin cycle? I mean, Putin himself kind of rose without trace, almost appeared out of nowhere to those of us who aren't looking closely as suddenly the most powerful man in the world. Whereabouts is that arc?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And we've been thinking about it. I've been writing about it for The Guardian for I guess more than a decade now, since I was in Moscow on and off, because Putin actually did a spell as prime minister before coming back in 2012 as president again. And while he was prime minister, there was speculation that maybe he was heading for the door. But now he is, in effect, he's a dictator. Actually, I think we can use the D word. It's a personalist regime. It's a one-man show. There's no obvious successor. I mean, Putin is not planning on retirement because he understands absolutely the nature of the system that he's created, that were he to step down, there are no guarantees that for his safety, for his assets, for his family, and so on. So he's there forever. Having said all that, I mean, he's in his mid-60s. There have been rumors during the rounds, none of them substantiated, that he may be ill. He's certainly quite isolated. I mean, I think that's true. Informationally isolated, cut off from what's going on, living in a world of paranoia and KGB fantasy where these protests in Russia are not organic. They're not caused by anything the regime is doing, but are basically organized, plotted by Western spies, by the CIA, by MI6. You know, probably by me, by you, by your listeners. Big podcast. The deep, dark podcast state, etc. So who knows? I mean, who knows whether there'll be kind of, you know, intra-elite moves against him or attempt to kind of bring in a few new fresh faces. But as I said before, it's a tired old show. And I think a lot of Russians increasingly are fed up with watching it.
Do you think the arrival of Joe Biden changes any of this? I mean, Trump was so servile. Biden, we don't yet know exactly what his posture will be, but it will not be as groveling as Trump's was.
It depends on the Biden administration's willingness to sanction oligarchs who are close to Putin. And the point is that if you're a billionaire in Russia and you're still in Russia, you're not in exile, then it's not like being a businessman. It's not like being Richard Branson or whoever. It means that when the phone rings and someone from the presidential administration or God forbid, Putin himself gets on the line and asks you to do something, you don't hesitate, right? You do it immediately because your money, your assets, your everything is provisional. You're sort of banded within that system. And so a lot of oligarchs for a long time, in the West, they hire lawyers to say that they're businessmen, that their fortunes are independently made, et cetera, et cetera. And back in Russia, of course, they play the game because they understand from, for example, what happened to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who spent a decade in jail, that if you defy Putin, I mean, Khodorkovsky was Russia's richest person at one point, then some very nasty things can happen to you. And so will Biden sanction these people? There's a Navalny list of 35 individuals, oligarchs, Kremlin figures, corrupt judges, or will they issue words of condemnation? The words of condemnation don't do much. They don't cut it. But if there is targeted sanctions against the billionaire elite, I don't know if that will bring political change, but it will certainly cause pain in Moscow.
Mm. You write in the book about the degree to which Russia has infiltrated Western society all the way from high politics to social media, you know, to business, to football. It's how Russia has shaped the West, you know, with the aim not of defeating and bringing down democracy, but simply of making us the same as them, dragging us down to Russia's level. 12 months after you published it, do you think we're still on that trajectory? Has the removal of Trump lanced that boil?
Well, I'm just actually in the process of writing an updated epilogue for Shadow State. But I mean, at the risk of sounding self-congratulatory and a bit of a twit. I sort of ended the last edition with saying that this shadow monster of the Russian security services, despite the stumble over the poisoning of Sergei Skripal, was on the rampage still and as deadly as ever. And basically 2 months after the book came out, this FSB kill squad tried to poison Navalny with Novichok, which is basically Navalny is my kind of last new chapter. So, of course, Putin will carry on. I mean, he understands these methods. He likes them. He is a master of conspiracy and of lying with a straight face. I mean, he sees deceit as a weapon. You lie to Angela Merkel, you lie to Boris Johnson, you disconcert the Europeans, whom he regards as a kind of weak, credulous, hesitant bunch. And that sort of, it's sort of weaponized lying almost. So that will carry on. So when they say, you know, we have a perfectly fair judicial system, Mr. Navalny unfortunately broke the rules, you know, blah, 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 blah. They don't expect you to believe them. They expect you to get the message that we are the masters here. We can do whatever we want. We'll poison our dissidents. We will jail our traitors. We will kick out European diplomats, which is what happened over the weekend. And we will, of course, you know, UK, by the way, will meddle in your elections and, you know, bring on the Scottish referendum, because it's pretty clear that the Kremlin wants UK breakup, Scottish secession, anything, frankly, to diminish London politically, economically, militarily, which is why they were so all in for Brexit. So yeah, we'll see more of this.
Luke Harding, thanks so much for joining us. It is, as ever, illuminating and terrifying to have you on. Shadow State, Murder, Mayhem, and Russia's Remaking of the West is out now, and it is jaw-dropping. Luke, is there any prospect of writing the West's remaking of Russia one day?
Well, I mean, this is already how Vladimir Putin's brain processes the world. I mean, we're all part of this swirling, amorphous conspiracy. You, Andrew Harrison, may be running a podcast, but obviously, actually, you're an MI6 operative, probably infiltrated years ago into the world of TV and media. I don't know, but I think at the moment, Putin, the people around him are embattled, and they are going to play nasty and play hard just because so much money is at stake, more than you and I can possibly even conceptualize.
I'm under such deep cover that I don't even know that I'm an agent, but I will not be visiting Salisbury at any time soon. Listeners, thanks for listening. Luke, thanks for joining us. Listeners, if you have a moment, please do give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts if you like. And if you'd like to support the show, search Patreon Bunker Podcast, sign up, you'll get the show early, plus mugs, t-shirts, and all kinds of good stuff. Thanks for listening. Until next time, Proshe Povieda Demokrati.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Intelligence Asset number 12808. By Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. An audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.